Welcome to the Institutional History Society's first podcast, The Mad, Bad and Bizarre, a brief review of Woking Invalid Convict Prison, Part 1. Your hosts for today are Daniel Shepherd and Gemma Minter.
Do we lock up a man to make him better, or prevent his getting worse? To keep him from doing more mischief, or solely as a retribution for the mischief he has done? On these points there would be no securing any unanimity of purpose. The Times, 14th of August, 1850. The times, both in terms of newspaper and centuries, have changed, but the question remains the same. What should society do to, and with, its malcontents? Woking Invalid Convict Prison is a prime example of a penal scheme wrangling with the above, at a time when great change and reform was sweeping through the country. By no means the most infamous, or indeed well-known prison, it is the perfect starting point for this podcast. But before we start talking about the convicts at this prison, first we must understand the prison itself, its purpose and conditions. We hope you enjoy.
Imprisonment in various forms has been in place in England for centuries, but the idea of mass incarceration being a viable long-term solution was not. Imprisoning an offender was simply a means of detention until a fitting punishment could be found. It wasn't considered a punishment in itself, and certainly not for groups of unrelated offenders.
The first conceptualization of a true mass prison wasn't until the 18th century, when philosopher Jeremy Bentham proposed his Panopticon prison. More on that in a later podcast. But by the time we get to the years preceding Woking Prison, the death penalty, hard labour or transportation to the colonies were typical punishments meted out to serious and not so serious lawbreakers. This would change, as around 1830, Australia, our main transportation location, was refusing to be a criminal dump, and this initiated a large-scale reform in England and her penal system. Penal reform was an iterative process, ongoing for the previous 100 years, but changes were slow to take effect. One staunch critic, Thomas Fowell Buxton, after inquiry into the state of British prisons in 1818, referred to them as an instructive warning of principles to be rejected and practices to be avoided in the management of prisons. Within 35 years, from 1842 to 1874, 90 prisons were built or enlarged to house those given prison sentences. We'll explore each of these prison phases at a later date, but for now, we'll start our discussion in Victorian England, circa 1850. Picture this. Prison overcrowding is rife. The sick, the consumptive, malodorous, and those smote with typhoid were housed pell-mell, a smorgasbord of infected and infirm in cramped cells with no thought for comfort or prevention. Or worse, housed in decommissioned ships where they were free to walk around and spread infection. Inmates, people would suffer, would contract new illnesses and sadly die.
This absolutely wasn't unusual, and alas, the risks were very well known. Some 75 years before, at Newgate Prison, one of the most famous, a sixth of the prison population, nearly 100 inmates, died from typhus. If the average mortality rates for our Victorian era of prosperity is 10 in 1,000, then prisoners were experiencing at least double that. Several parliamentary and social health reforms were passed, notably in 1835, when we have the first prison inspectors. To me, the most shocking part of this is that the first factory inspectors were appointed in 1802, after the Health and Morals Act, but it took 33 long years before we considered our convicts. But anyway, these reforms eventually resulted in the creation of a temporary invalid convict prison at Lewes, after the previous prisons and hulks were considered to be too dangerous, particularly for the infirm.
The prison at Lewis was deemed a success, and plans to build a permanent structure, away from the miasmas that were still believed to be causing disease, were made for the healthy town of Woking. The plot for the Woking Invalid Convict Prison was purchased from the London Necropolis Company in 1858, and work immediately began in earnest. The northeastern wing, housing the most robust prisoners, was the first part to be completed, and Woking Prison officially accepted its first inmate on the 28th of April, 1859, one William Strahan, a bent banker who scandalised Victorian England. If you're interested in his life and crimes, have a look at his profile on the convict section of our site. William was the first inmate from Lewis Prison, but was joined within the fortnight by another 94 inmates who would help him finish the building of Woking Prison, ready for the formal reception of the invalid prisoners from October. But how did these men end up here, and why were they chosen to build the prison? What horrible, terrible things were committed in order for them to toil in hard labour, in the sun, in the snow, in the wind? On the whole, theft of personal property. Shocking, right? But it makes sense. An ordinary crime of opportunity, not too malicious, and generally not dangerous. Most of these inmates were only on a 3 or 4 year sentence, and therefore unlikely to escape. In addition, they were generally young, seemingly healthy, with mostly useful trades, such as labourers, agricultural workers, and stonemasons. Thus, it would appear they were chosen to be the perfect docile pack horses, to build and then bugger off.
That's the theory anyway, but as the old saying goes, there are exceptions to every rule.
For us, the most horrific inmate in this initial tranche of convicts is John Monks. We first come across him in the 1859 prisoner logs for Woking, prisoner number 41. He is listed as being 22, 5'3", fair-skinned with auburn hair, blue eyes and sandy whiskers. He has a wife, Elizabeth, who awaits him in St. Helens, and his character record throughout his penal service is listed as very good. His crime was rape, gang rape, by far the most violent of all the 94 convicts sent to finish the building of Woking's prison, but surprisingly, not so shocking to those who sentenced him. John was sentenced to 4 years, the same as Richard Turvey, another of our 94, who stole a shawl.
Initially we thought there must have been a mistake, clerical or otherwise. But no. A contemporary newspaper article from the Liverpool Mercury documented it as a vicious gang rape on a woman walking home at 10 p.m. on a Monday evening, and worse, with her blind friend. Ellen Oakley, the victim, was 45. John Monks would have been 18 or 19 at the time. He and two of his young friends beat her so badly that part of her lip was bitten clear away.
Clearly this was not some prank gone awry, a misunderstanding. This was premeditated sexual violence. So why did the criminal get so low a sentence? There are other instances of rape, where the perpetrator gets a higher sentence. Why then was he different? Was it due somehow to the nature of the circumstances of the woman, or the fact that the man was a gainfully employed collier who paid his taxes?
Realistically, it is likely to be a combination of the two. Ellen Oakley was listed as cohabiting with a man who was not her husband. There are some considerations that she may have been a prostitute, and that would definitely count against her, even as a victim. And the biggest tragedy is that as a female, and a working class one, she was worth very little to the judge, to the jury, and to the general public in 1855. That there was a conviction at all seems somewhat laudable in an age where it was considered almost impossible to rape a spouse or a woman of easy virtue.
Terrible. From the most violent to the youngest. Henry Tasker is our youngest inmate, aged 15 in 1859, and at the end of a 4-year sentence for receiving stolen property. He had also a previous conviction. A bricklayer by trade, it's very likely that this is a skill gained in prison rather than one he entered into, as prison service often included training in useful, profitable trades like labouring, shoemaking and carpentry. This, his age and skills, were likely one of the reasons why he was included in the 94 inmates. As mentioned before, the majority of the first batch of inmates were there for theft or non-violent crimes with small impacts on society.
A large proportion of the larcenies were foodstuffs. Pigs, sheep, barley, potatoes. And while some of these thefts were clearly made with the intent to sell, like prisoner number 19, John Marsh's pig theft, and prisoner number 91, John Hargreaves' theft of 16 geese. As an aside, one does wonder how easy it was to steal 16 geese, because quite frankly, one live goose is a crowd on its own. We don't know, however, if the victim of Enoch Hall's duck theft relied on that bird for their daily eggs, with no other means of support. Some of these will be crimes of luxury, a means to enrich lives and make a quick buck. Others of necessity. Prisoner number 57, Benjamin Freeman, a 32-year-old agricultural labourer with a wife and 3 children to support.
Benjamin was convicted of stealing barley. As a farm labourer, he wouldn't have owned a farm himself, but would be reliant on local farms for casual labour. One can easily imagine how one bad season, one failed crop and drought of work would drive this man to theft, for fear of starvation and the threat of the workhouse never far behind. From theft to the receiving of stolen property, and James Wood, prisoner number 69, convicted of receiving a horse while knowing the same to have been stolen. James was a 28-year-old higgler, a peddler of small items, and a horse would conceivably have been beyond his means. So perhaps this was an opportunity he just couldn't let slip by, an easy receipt and sell. As the saying goes, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. He was caught and sentenced to 4 years of penal service. Another interesting group of convicts in this initial set is that of the military criminals, deserters, drunks, and strikers of officers. One Andrew McMullen, a soldier in Quebec, was court-martialed for striking a superior officer with an open hand. Note the attention to detail here. Would a closed hand have been better or worse? All in good time. That officer in question was Dr. Griffin, supposedly just doing his duty. One wonders what medical procedure could have engendered such a response, especially considering another soldier, Michael Devitt, struck him with a fist less than a year later. He received a life sentence in comparison to Andrew's paltry 4 years. What a difference a clench makes. Clearly the good doctor had a less than impressive bedside manner. Neither of these men are noted to have been drunk at the time, though, understandably, in terrible conditions and the looming threat of death in front and overhead, one might be tempted to overindulge in tipples now and then. Like Edward Mayer, an American from South Carolina, who was assumed to be drunk when he attempted to stab his captain and desert from Quebec. He got 4 years. Thank God he didn't punch him. William Clark, another deserter from Quebec, in 1855 attempted to abscond with regimental articles, perhaps to pawn for his travel back to the UK. Pawning was a bustling underworld industry at this time, and was fed by the fruits of clothing theft. Clothes in the early Victorian era were expensive to make, and most people had one or two sets at most. Sewing was still done by hand until 1856 at the earliest. And so the used clothes market made a tremendous trade.
Indeed, it was normal for clothes from a wealthy family to be passed down to maidservants, who wouldn't wear them themselves, but would sell them on, multiple times. They were used for many, many years before they'd finally end up in the ragbag of a housewife.
Places like Paddy's Market in Liverpool and Petticoat Lane in London would have been very good places to pass off the stolen property. Unless, that is, you're Stephen Godfrey from Spitalfields, who was convicted for the theft of 5 dresses and other articles. One can only assume that he meant to sell them on before they were wore out.
And also for the rag gatherer James Brown. James was charged with stealing a chemise from a hedge. He was sentenced to 4 years of penal servitude for his first conviction. This was a dying crime. By 1870, the ready-to-wear market was booming, selling mass-produced, machine-made clothes for most price ranges. Now, only the very desperate would need to resort to rags, remnants, and the shonky shop.
From violent acts to acts of God, from fighting starvation to fleeing conflict, our first 94 inmates were a real mix of Victorian life.
Of these prisoners who built this prison, only 3 remained in Woking until 1860, and they were all released in January. Surprisingly, there were no deaths. A rare occurrence for Woking prisoners, we'll soon see.
So plug in for the next episode, where we will be exploring the first true inhabitants of this prison, their lives, their crimes, and calamities. We'll meet them soon. Thank you for listening to the Institutional History Society's first podcast. We couldn't have got this far without the wonderful London Archives and the Woking Lightbox. Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his music in our podcast.
Any comments, requests or feedback, please send through to institutionalhistory@gmail.com. To find out more, sign up to our monthly newsletter on our website, institutionalhistory.com.